Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, victims unite once more with Sabine McNeil in exile on the European continent. Also, demonstration here in Bristol City Centre on the day of the budget. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But first today, we're joined on the line by Sabine McNeil from Brussels. Sabine, you've been lobbying Brussels. For a lot of people, they decide that they want to lobby Westminster or the Scottish Parliament. Why Brussels?
Well, we've been at the end of the road in London. We've submitted, thanks to John Hemming MP, a petition to the UK government about children placed in foster care and never got a response. We had made a submission to the education committee when they were investigating child protection. We have submitted a petition, thanks to John Hemming. And of course, John Hemming himself was ever so active in Westminster. So in a way, we didn't need to. But it was then a Belgian journalist who had made a major report on children going missing in the UK and won a prize, and she had spoken to MEPs in Brussels, and therefore she suggested that we should get a petition going in Brussels, and we need 2,000 signatures, and therefore I started to collect signatures online, and wrote the document necessary to submit it, and one fine day we had a hearing. Not only me on behalf of the 2,000 signers, but also Laila Bryce, the Latvian mother whose daughter was taken by Merton Council, but also a German father who can't see his son after there was a judgment made in his favor in Malta, but that's been ignored by the UK. And that's one of the typical patterns that we observe. The UK doesn't honor judgments that come from other countries. So that's one of the reasons why there was a need to go to Brussels.
Now, there's a sort of almost a pattern emerging here, isn't there, of a whole process taking many years to even get started. No real justice through the court system, at least for many of these cases. And then when there is something done at a national level, you're strung along for a few months, maybe even a couple of years, and then everything hits a brick wall finally. So that's, you know, am I being unfair to say that's the sort of pattern of resistance to justice you've met here in Britain?
Oh, no, that's very correct. That's very well described. I mean, there was just no response, or always only the kind of letter, everything is hunky-dory, the law is clear, and nobody cares about the gap between what they say and what they do.
Now, some people would say, wouldn't they, that the abusers of various sorts have had a hand in this. Is that a little bit going a bit too far, do you think?
No, I think that is quite clear. Let's call a spade a spade. The abusers are pedos, and they are everywhere. And they wouldn't have prevented us in the worst of all cases, where the two children described the abuse they've suffered so badly. The cover-ups were just so horrendous that they can only be attributed to pedos. Of course, that wasn't quite as visible and apparent until that case came about. But what was very visible and very apparent was that it was virtually impossible to get children back once they were in the care of the council. It was virtually impossible to find a lawyer or a barrister who would work in favor of the client. And it was virtually impossible to find a judge who would do what they call a fair trial, Article 6 in Brussels.
What about the petition then that you've been looking at over in Brussels, this idea of stopping adoption without consent? Why have you gone for that particular line in the petition?
I trusted Florence Belloni, who gave me that suggestion after she had spoken with MEPs. I guess they would have known whether the topic had been debated in any shape or form, and they would have known what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And of course, forced adoption has always been the topic that Ian Josephs had pushed as well. His website is called forcedadoption.com. And Ian Josephs is the person with a law degree from Oxford and who had been a counselor in Kent and who has observed cases for over 50 years. He reckons he has accompanied about 1,000 cases a year. He still gets anything between 6 and 10 phone calls a day.
Now, we know a lot of young people, particularly children, get abused in the care system. Am I right in thinking that your real aim is to make sure that if it is proven in court that a parent is not able to look after their child, that they should really check make sure there's nobody else in their entire extended family that can do that?
Well, you see, the tragedy is that John Hemming used to say the social services get involved when they shouldn't and they don't get involved when they should. So it's distinctly our observation that abusive parents are the exception, whereas what is clear is that the state or the social services in their eagerness to take children are the rule. I mean, Channel 4 have made a film on forced adoptions, 15,000 kids and counting, and they advertise right on their banner, a child is taken every 20 minutes, 1,000 a month. I mean, there cannot be that many bad parents in the UK, and there cannot be an increase of 26% in social deterioration either. In my view, this is more an indicator of greed for money.
And also, you were talking before, weren't you, about the VIP defiles, people in positions of power, Whitehall, Westminster, public figures, so-called leaders that are involved in this. What do you think is actually the motive? Because I know a lot of people have pointed out that that paedophilia is actually quite handy in political blackmail. If someone is in a powerful position, it's very easy to blackmail them if they've been involved in paedophilia.
Yeah, I have not looked into that aspect so much because I'm always sort of on the side of the victims. But in the case of these two whistleblower children, a fabulous website has emerged called Hampstead Research. It was unfortunately closed down and has re-emerged as Research Hampstead now. And they are looking into the 70 plus abusers of these 20 children altogether, whom the two whistleblower children are talking about. They can name the abusers. They know that there is VIP child abuse. A very good blog called the Coleman Experience.wordpress.com has written very well about VIP child abuse. The child abuse in homes seems to be clearly the pattern, but I also know from foster parents that they abuse. I've quoted before the Nigerian family where the oldest daughter was molested by the son of the foster parents. The boy asked, "Mummy, what is pedophilia? Why would he learn such a word from foster parents?" The second daughter said that they were taken to dark places at night where there are only men. Now, this organized child snatching for the purpose of paedophilia, child trafficking, adoption, organs, whatever it is just a horrible industry by now. And it's clearly something sort of from case to case to know what the genuine purpose is. But the industry has to be kept moving so that the paedophiles can also benefit. And therefore, it's pretty clear that it's been run by paedophiles in the first place. We know for a fact that judges have been discovered to be paedos. And I have seen one particular case where one of the social workers was very clear, the boy, the 12-year-old boy had written about that he is afraid. A 12-year-old Portuguese boy talked about rape and was afraid for himself and his younger brother.
Now, why is this whistleblower kids case in Hampstead? Why hasn't it been in the newspapers at all in Britain much? I mean, I think maybe one article in the Daily Mail, but one would have thought that there would at least be some kind of news intervention or, you know, somebody would be looking at it from the British media.
No. The mainstream media are part of the problem, not of the solution, Tony.
So why is that? I mean, why is it they're not even reporting the fact that, that these websites are being closed down and, you know, there are reports of whistleblowers, even, you know, children? The thing is, of course, maybe it's just simply because they're children, they're not necessarily credible witnesses, are they?
No, I think you've touched upon it a bit more when you were talking about the blackmailability of VIPs. And I'm sorry to say that the ultimate of a bond between paedophiles, or if you like, between a small percentage of paedophiles, who am I to know, seems to be what the children have described, these ritual cults.
Focus down a little bit on why it is the press in London are really not covering this. Is it simply because the children are so young, they're not credible witnesses?
No, that's definitely not the explanation, because the judge has used the mainstream media to convey her message. And that has happened for the first time in the case of Vicky Hague, when the then president of the family division made a judgment in favor of the abuser and used the mainstream media to paint a bad picture of the mother. And this is exactly what now the High Court Judge Powfully has done in the case of the whistleblower. So she has, with that press release, made Satanism, if you like, topical in the same way that Jimmy Savile had made paedophilia topical, but she dismisses the claims. She said that the allegations of the children were baseless.
Well, what about your own case, Sabine? Because, you know, you're there on the continent, going between Belgium, Germany, France, places like that, but you can't come to the UK. So why can't you? And how's the case going?
My own case. Yeah. I have a law firm that has applied for legal aid, and I'm glad about that firm because they have one lawyer to cover the secret family court, where I'm supposedly in contempt of court, just like the mother, same judgment. And the other side is the police, who want us both for discussion. That's why she's as abroad as I am.
Well, hang on, because you can discuss with police on Skype, can't you?
Oh, they don't. They want me personally. They wouldn't, and the court as well. I have asked for a Skype. No. They want me personally. It's proof. They want to put me in handcuffs.
Okay.
They want me behind bars.
What about the phone? What about on the phone? No, they don't want to talk to you on the phone.
No. You have to realize they want me in handcuffs and behind bars. I'm too much of a danger and of a troublesome person for them.
Okay.
Too much of an exposer.
We had Maurice Kirk on here a couple of weeks ago talking about his exploits, being the first person to fly under the Severn Bridge in an RAF chipmunk when it was first put up in the 1960s. But Maurice, he's also, you know, he's had all sorts of trouble with the police. He was in South Wales police. He was suing them because they kept several times a week pulling him over and asking him to produce his documents, even though he'd produced them many, many times the previous weeks. And then he was actually incarcerated by them for something completely different, really, in order to stop that case proceeding. How's Maurice getting on? And how on earth did you discover that someone who was trying to help him with his case ended up being a police informer?
Well, the Maurice, thank God, can use Skype as well so that we can talk. The police informer became apparent because he withheld money and then used a barrister from Chambers that had kind of been troublesome before. So Maurice is on that trail. With respect to the Barnet police troubling me, that is on behalf of the abusers. They feel harassed by the fact that their names were published, which I categorically did not do, neither did the mother. In fact, there are two people who indicated that the publication of those documents came, or that one document came from MI5, which would confirm also what you were suspecting before. And I read a document somewhere where they say how they kind of play these games. So
I mean, is the main problem here, Sabine, really, that you're playing a bit too much hardball? You should be calling these people alleged abusers, not abusers. And of course, if someone isn't, then they're bound to fight back.
Well, I'm sorry. I am not. I haven't done that, and I'm not talking about and to the abusers either. And the people who run the Hampstead Research Blog, they are targeting the abusers, and they keep talking about alleged abusers. That's very true. I can't help it that the police wants me for discussion because those alleged abusers feel harassed. I did not harass them.
Now, do you feel a little bit like Julian Assange or Edward Snowden, you know, with the sort of information you've got, actually could bring down or even bring to court some very important people?
Well, I don't know. I just did what I did, and I am doing what I'm doing because I happen to have a brain which is as logical as a computer, and I am made of a style where I like to call a spade, Tony. And I like to publish things, and I follow very clearly Ian Joseph's advice. When I spoke to him and asked what on earth can we do, he said exposure, exposure, exposure. There was a reformer in the 18th century who said publicity is the very soul of justice. When there is no publicity, there can't be justice, basically, because it keeps the judge sort of under control. And therefore, I'm really fighting above all else the secrecy of the family courts. That and how this secrecy has been abused in the case of the whistleblower kids to hide criminal activities. That's what was an appendix that I added to the petition on the adoption in March this year. That's why I'm hoping that that'll be scheduled at some stage as well. But since then, we've produced the report, which I will add also to the petition, which is about the discrepancy between an EU directive on combating sexual abuse and the UK family law courts. And it's this process of harmonizing law across EU countries that is really also at stake. Because there has been one report by a Russian parliamentarian on social services across Europe. When is it okay to remove a child from a birth family? And now there has been, what was on the agenda yesterday, a UK academic expert who had written a 72-page report on the law and adoption. But the problem there is, once again, she basically confirms in a long version what ministers have always written. The law is clear, everything is hunky-dory, never mind what social services are doing on the ground, never mind what the police is doing on the ground, because the social services never take children without police. And this gap between EU law on one level and EU countries on the other is what will hopefully be addressed in a plenary debate in Strasbourg in September or October. That's what we're working on next.
Some people say that David Cameron's refusal to, or attempt anyway, to get rid of the Human Rights Act here in Britain is related to this, because actually many of the Tory party members, the majority anyway, some Labour too, but mostly Tories, might be prosecuted under it.
Yes, but I mean, I wonder which judge or which prosecutor you would find who would prosecute a colleague, you know, or a buddy from the Old Boys Network or a former school colleague. I mean, I've just found a few interesting articles in Newsweek, already published quite some time ago, that allegations come from the elite schools, that the UK care system has been found disgraceful because of the number of children going missing. I mean, the more you look, the more is coming out now on the full spectrum of issues. So that's why the tagline on the Whistleblower Kids blog for me is from child snatching to forced adoptions and child sexual abuse and then satanic ritual abuse at the far end. That is a really hard path to follow. I call it gradual shock therapy. You can't really believe that it is as bad as it is.
Now, can you wind up, Sabine, by reminding us of the websites for the Whistleblower Kids case and your own Victims Unite?
Well, whistleblowerkids.co.uk, I've actually been advised to close the blog, and but I'll have it open so I don't update it anymore, because it's a reference, it's factual, and it's for informative reasons it's there. Victimsunite.net, victims-unite, or victims-unite.net is still my most popular blog. I've just put my Brussels news there. I've actually found in the blogging sphere, there are more and more people publishing news. So if they use WordPress, then I just need to reblog. So the news that I'm creating are now mainly relating to the National Enquiry. I have one blog that's called nationalenquiry.wordpress.com. That is dear to me because it was triggered by a person who was an abuse survivor and became a whistleblower of pedophilia in Lambeth, and he has acted as a McKenzie friend on behalf of other victims. And that is kind of a serious issue, how he became the victim of three police forces then as well, and in prison, very similar to Maurice. I would nearly like to think that, I mean, Maurice is clearly the worst of all people having been victimized in the way that I've seen. But Brian Peed is maybe second, and it's just horrendous how he's been moved from prison to prison above all, and has been charged with impersonating a barrister only because he helped as a McKenzie friend. I mean, these false charges are just part of the problem.
Now, it's also difficult, I said finally, but it is also difficult, isn't it, to advise people to go to the police when you hear bits of news that have just come out in the last week or so that a paedophile who kept a girl in his car boot during a horrific campaign of sexual abuse has finally been jailed after the victim reported it to the police four times and the police did nothing about it.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Tony, because Ian Josephs actually advises mothers not to report the crimes of their abusive fathers to the police because they end up losing their children. And that is part of the problem.
So where do people go, though? Where do people go, Sabine?
Yeah, they flee the country.
All right. Well, Sabine, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're welcome. Thanks, Tony.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now by Dunstan Bruce, who's a singer with the band Chumbawamba. Hi, Dunstan, welcome to Dialect.
Good evening.
Now, you're trying to raise some money to make a film, aren't you? Now, this is actually a proper professional film, maybe even be shown on TV, but tell us what the premise of the film is. I think many of us can remember the name of the band Chumbawamba, but what happened?
Well, I think that's sort of the idea of the film, really, is that a lot of people just know that one song, the Tub Thumping, I Get Knocked Down song. And I want to tell the story of who that band was and what we'd been doing the 15 years prior to having that hit single. And then once we got into that situation of being a political band in the mainstream, what we actually managed to achieve once we were there, and did we achieve anything that was worthwhile? And how did we all experience that that adventure?
I think, Dunstan, we're going to have to start by having a listen to that song.
I'm not afraid to die.
That was I Get Knocked Down from Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba. Dunstan Bruce is on the line, the singer with Chumbawamba. Why is it that we only heard that one song, One Hit Wonder?
It pretty much was a situation of that being the only song that really bothered the charts, and that was never planned. You know, it was an accident. It was to my mind, it was an accident that song was even a hit. We did have, you know, we'd been doing music for 15 years prior to that and 15 years after that, and it was just that song came along at the right time, and it just caught the country's imagination and seemed to just take off massively.
But what happened afterwards?
Well, we spent 2 years travelling around playing that song over and over and over and over and over again. And we then wrote an album that was nothing like the album that Tub Thumping was on. And it absolutely bombed and it didn't have a hit single on. And we wrote it about... and we spent so much time in America that we wrote it a lot about our experience there, and it just didn't sell in the slightest. Some people were burnt out by the experience, and it's something that I want to explore anyway, is how we all experienced that that roller coaster ride we went on.
Now, isn't anything to do with Dan But No Bacon not being part of the band anymore?
No, Dan But left at the same time I did, and Alice and Harry all in 2005.
All right, so he was still part of the band. So what's the point of the film?
The point of the film is, it's twofold, because the band called it A Day in 2012. I thought this was a story that couldn't be lost. I thought this is such a fascinating adventure that we went on. I want to tell that story. I don't want it to get lost in, you know, like just like being a footnote in some book on One Hit Wonders or something. But also, I was like, after particularly around the last election, I was aware of the fact that there was very little political pop around. There was very few people actually saying something about the political situation, and I just thought, This is outrageous. Like if Chumbawamba had still been around, they would have had plenty to say about this. So for me as well, it's like trying to give people a kick up the backside as well as trying to be inspirational. You know, like to say, look, pop, you can combine pop and politics, and it can work.
Why is it, do you think, that there's so little nowadays then?
I just think there's not very much in the mainstream. I think there's a lot of political music exists outside of the mainstream. It's just, I don't think there's that sort of crossover as much. I think it's I think what we hear on the radio and on TV has got narrower and narrower and narrower, and we're not presented with music that's challenging or different in the mainstream.
Okay, so how do listeners find your crowdfunding site for the film?
If you go to the Kickstarter website and put in "I Get Knocked Down," you'll find it then, or you can put in Dunstan Bruce or "I Get Knocked Down" and you will find the Kickstarter campaign.
Okay, and if anyone here in Bristol's thinking the same as you, and certainly I am, it's a little bit strange that the BBC isn't playing this kind of stuff. I noticed also this week that they have said that they're not allowed to play The Doors for some strange reason, something to do with copyright. We will never hear The Doors now on the BBC. It's annoying, isn't it? And so we're going to play some of that here on BCFM after we've heard from Dunstan Bruce's band, Chumbawamba, doing another song which was released just before, called Enough Is Enough.
Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Is enough, is enough.
Give the fascist man a gunshot.
Enough is enough, is enough.
Give the fascist man a gunshot.
In old Vienna, under heavy manners. What's going on? What the hell is going on? We all stood waiting.
gunshots. We got bored and tired, it wasn't hip anymore. They were playing our tune,
but it was cleaning the dance floor.
How many of us does it take to change a light bulb?
Answer!
It's easier to stay in the dark, so here we go again.
Same idea,
different song. Where have all the anti-fascists gone? The words get tired when you hear them every day.
We'll be right back.
And Dunstan Bruce, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Hey, cheers. That's no problem. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about the film.
And that was Dunstan Bruce from Chumbawamba and the song from 1994, Enough is Enough. As I mentioned there in that interview, the BBC have come up over the last couple of weeks with a very strange command to their DJs and producers all around the corporation. It's reported by Michael Han in The Guardian on the Thursday, the 9th of July. Don't play Neil Young or The Doors, the BBC tells DJs and programme makers. The two acts are among four the corporation cannot play. The way music's broadcast seems to change daily, he says, but it's usually a case of more music being made available in more different ways. Now, though, the reverse is happening. The BBC has told its producers and DJs not to play music by Neil Young, The Doors, Journey or Bonnie Raitt, or any cover versions of their songs or tracks which sample them, even only just for a few seconds. Well, the BBC may be saying it, but BCFM is not actually bound by those regulations. So let's have a listen to a classic by The Doors now, Riders on the Storm.
Thank you. Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone, an actor out on loan. Riders on the storm.
From 1971, The Doors there, real classic track, Riders on the Storm, which I'm afraid you're not going to hear at all on the BBC, since they had a command sent down from on high to BBC's producers, as reported in The Guardian by Michael Hann, Thursday 9th of July. Don't play Neil Young or The Doors, BBC tells DJs and programme makers. Well, you can hear it here on BCFM.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, if you haven't noticed, there's been an emergency budget. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, passed on Wednesday the 8th of July. Bristol reacted with a protest, I won't say necessarily spontaneous, probably organised on social media, that kind of thing, in Castle Park with about 300 people. And Joe Bryden was there. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Joe, what made you want to go along to this protest?
Yeah, well, partly the fact that the budget hit really hard the people who need the support of the government the most, but also the fact that austerity itself doesn't work. Instead of helping the economy recover, it just centralises the money in the hands of the wealthy, when really we need to move money within the country's economy. Also the fact that we don't really seem to have this need to cut back when we always have enough money for war. We're spending £40 billion each year on the military. We could save £7 billion just by halving MOD procurement. So this huge clash of priorities just seems completely heartless and to be affecting the people who really need the help and lining the pockets of those who don't.
Now, how old are you, Joe, and how are you qualified to talk on this?
Well, I'm not really qualified. I guess my only qualification is that I care. But I'm 18, so in limbo between sixth form and university. And I just think it's kind of everybody's duty to take an interest in the world around them. Otherwise, democracy wouldn't really be effective if we were all completely apathetic.
Now, have you just done A-levels? You're doing A-levels now. And what sort of subjects have you been doing at school?
Yeah, I've just finished A-levels in history, sociology, English language and music thrown in there. Going on to study history at university.
Great. Well, history and sociology, what do they teach us about the sort of things that's going on in government today?
Unfortunately, very little. It seems that those who set the curriculum seem to only be interested, particularly in history, in teaching us about the glories of the past, Crimean War and that. And a lot of sociology seems very, very theoretical, based on you know, changing family patterns, divorce rates, death rates, nothing really cutting edge. So I've got to, if I want to learn about that, I guess I've got to learn outside the classroom.
Well, one other thing I would point out was that back in the 1700s, there was something called the Hellfire Club in West Wickham, I think it was near High Wickham, which was a club where there was prostitution going on with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Francis Dashwood, at the time, was leading this little club. They called themselves the Monks of Medmenham, and what they were doing was they were taking high-class prostitutes. Now, he was Chancellor for a little while. He was doing the same kind of thing, actually, as George Osborne, doing loads and loads of cuts. And even back in the 17th century, he was kicked out of office. So I wonder, how come, if, as you say, Osborne's policies are actually hurting the economy, how come he's managing to cling on?
Well, mainly because the public aren't getting the true message about austerity. They're hearing what the media says. The media says, you know, if you're in debt, you cut back. We're in debt, we cut back. So implying that the country's economy works the same way as a family or an individual's budget. Not true. They're giving us an overly simplified message. So a lot of it's keeping the public in the dark. You know, this whole thing of manufactured consent that Noam Chomsky talks about so much. And part of it's, of course, the fact that we don't really live in a true system of democracy. We live in a place where our political representation is limited to one day every 5 years. And that's one of the reasons that protests, like what we saw last Wednesday, is such a huge important part of the political workings of this country. It's one of our few opportunities to actually get involved and make a difference.
Any websites or whatever you'd like to point out, finally, to just draw our attention to?
It's always good to check out the People's Assembly. They're on Facebook. You can also Google them or use any other search engine that takes your fancy. And they've got lots of great stuff about austerity. At the moment, I'm reading a book by Paul Krugman, latest Nobel Prize winner in economics. He writes some very interesting things about what actually is money. And then the website itself, Positive Money, has a very, very different approach of how to stimulate the economy by actually putting money into it and getting money moving around.
Well, the big lesson, of course, is Iceland, isn't it? They've started giving more money to people who are on the dole in Iceland, and their economy's picked up almost straight away. Anyway, Joe, thanks very much for joining us on
Not
Dialect.
At all. Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests Sabine McNeil, Dunstan Bruce from Chumbawamba, and Joe Bryden, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. I will leave you with Urch Font's finest, Bob Naylor.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. And we come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. And we come to work the grounds in common and to make the wastelands grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. And they made the laws to chain us well. And the clergy dazzled us with heaven, or they damned us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve. The
god of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. And we work to knead together, we need no swords. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent unto the lords, for we are free, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the man of property the orders came. They sent the hired men and the troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We came in peace, the orders came to cut them down. They came in peace, the orders came to cut them down. In Newland Town I was bred and born, at Stephen's Green there I died in scorn. I served my time at the sadder's trade, and I was always, and I was always a roving blade. At 17, oh, I took a wife, and I loved her dear as I loved my life. To keep her happy both night and day, I took to robbing, I took to robbing on the broad highway. And I robbed Lord Golding, I do declare, and the lady man stood in Grosvenor Square. I shut the shutters and bid them good night. And home I took me loot, and home I took me loot to me heart's delight. Covent Garden, I went straightway to Covent Garden to see the play. Ned Fielding's gang there did me pursue, and I was taken, and I was taken by that cursed crew. Well, when I'm dead and go to me grave, a fine and a flashy funeral let me have. Get six bold highwaymen to carry me. Give them broad swords, oh, give them broad swords and sweet liberty. And six pretty doxies, you'll carry me, Paul. Give them white ribbons and gloves and all. And when I'm gone, they will tell the truth. There goes a wild young man, there goes a wild young man and a wicked youth. I'll sing you a song of a young London waterman who from Blackfriars did regular fly, and he feathered his oars with such skill and dexterity, pleasing each heart and delighting each eye. And he sang so sweet, he sang so merry, the couples all clamoured to hire his ferry, and it became known as the Young Lover's Ferry. But he never had a true love of his own. Then there came a young goose girl from Stratford St. Mary's, and she wanted taking to Farringdon Fair, but she had not a halfpenny to pay for a ferry, and stood on the banks in a pretty despair. And she sang so sweet, she sang so merry, he put her and all of her geese in his ferry, and her pretty face was the fair for a fairy, and took her across to Farringdon Fair. They were married next morning in Stratford St. Mary's, and now they have watermen 1, 2, 3, 4, and they feather their oars with such skill and dexterity, taking the people from shore to shore. And they sing so sweet, they sing so merry, the couples all clamour to hire their ferry. Now everyone goes by the Blackfriars ferry, while he stays at home with the love of his own.